welcome to How to Listen to and Understand Opera. Lectures 1 through 4 are conceived of as a large introductory set consisting of three separate parts, and I will tell you what they are now, and then we will move on. Part 1 of our introductory set is a general introduction to and definition of opera and a discussion of opera's enduring popularity. Part 2 of our introductory set of lectures is a presentation I call Words and Music, and I hope it will amuse you. And the third part of our large introductory set of lectures is a brief but extremely intense history of expression in vocal music from the time of ancient Greece to the years around 1600. I trust I am not biting off a tad bit too much, but we will get through it, I guarantee. But first, my friends, I have a story to tell you, so please check it out. Our story takes place in China, in ancient Beijing. The daughter of the Chinese emperor, the haughty and beautiful Princess Turandot, has promised to marry any man of royal blood who can solve three riddles posed by her. If he should fail to come up with the proper answers, he will be beheaded. I would tell you that the walls of the city are already decorated with the heads of unsuccessful suitors. This is a whole new twist on the concept of the dating game. Bachelor number 3. Wrong. Off comes that head. Yes, indeed. Clearly, this sort of quiz and kill has put a major crimp in the princess's social life, and if you'll excuse me, has taken a rather large slice off the top of the local royal families. Anyway, among the crowd at the latest execution, this one of the Prince of Persia, is Timur. Timur is the old blind Tartar king, and his son, the prince, Caliph. Timur and Caliph are in disguise because currently they are being pursued by enemies, so rather than wearing the finery of their office, they are wearing the clothes of peasants. Caliph, the young prince, is sickened and horrified by the spectacle of the Prince of Persia's beheading. Just as he's about to spew the nastiest curses in the direction of the princess, he gets a clear look at her. And, of course, he is utterly enraptured. He falls hopelessly and helplessly in love with this beautiful creature. He then mounts the platform, Caliph does. He strikes the great gong 3 times, indicating that he is to be the next challenger wishing to solve the riddles. Now, my friends, once again, we are left to ponder the native intelligence of post-adolescent princes, Caliph's smarts in particular. All right, it's just a story, so let's continue. And I will make a long story short for our purposes right now. Caliph indeed manages to solve the riddles. Turandot is appalled, and she begs her father not to force her to honor the agreement. Look, if nothing else, Dad, look at the way this guy is dressed, for goodness sake. Caliph offers that if she can discover who he is and what his name is before dawn, she will be freed from her vow and he will allow himself to be beheaded. Again, one wonders about Caliph's intelligence, but he seems to know something that the rest of us do not. Her father, the emperor, agrees to this deal. Turandot commands that no one shall sleep until the stranger's name is discovered. And by the way, she tells the palace staff that if they don't discover the stranger's name, they will instead be beheaded, thus adding a little work incentive to the issue at hand. Caliph himself, of course, is utterly certain that he will be victorious. And this is what we call in the trade an aria opportunity. Caliph can sing about his confidence, sing about his position, sing about his joy at having solved the riddles. So, these are the words that the co-librettists, that is, the co-writers of this story, Giuseppe Adami and Renato Simoni, supplied to the composer Giacomo Puccini for this moment in the opera Turandot of 1924. Caliph sings, Nessun dorma, nessun dorma. No one shall sleep, no one shall sleep. You too, princess, in your cold room, are watching the stars which tremble with love and hope. But my secret lies hidden within me. No one will know my name. No, no, I will reveal it only on your lips when daylight breaks forth, and my kiss will break the silence which makes you mine. Meanwhile, off stage, we hear the women of Beijing singing, nobody will know his name, and we will have to die, alas, die. Caliph sings again, depart, O night, quickly set stars, at dawn I will win, I will win, I will win, Vincero, Vincero, Vincero. And thus ends the aria. Now, here's the question we must ponder. How will Puccini set these words? It's up to Puccini to take these words and put them to music. So we say he's going to set the words. What words in the text will he use as his cue to create the mood of the following aria? For example, Vincero, Vincero. Strident, victorious words. Should this be a strident victory march for Caliph? Well, it's a possibility if he takes the cue from Vincero. How about Caliph's line, but my secret lies hidden within me? Well, if Puccini decides to use those words as his cue, this could be a sly and mysterious and quiet aria. Perhaps the offstage women have supplied the mood for this aria. Filled with terror and fear and anxiety that they are, we will have to die, we will have to die. Will this be a nervous and heart-rending aria? None of the above. Puccini's choice is as follows. He sets these words as a sublime and glorious serenade to the princess, to the stars, and to the oncoming dawn. Nessun Dorma becomes a transcendent love song, which finally explains the depth and power of the prince's infatuation with the princess, his willingness to risk everything, and his conviction. You too, princess, are watching the stars which tremble with love and hope. His conviction that the princess herself is desperate for love. Please, let's listen to this aria. Let's contemplate this text. And then talk a little more about the choices Puccini makes in writing this particular music.
Oh.
Well, wow and double wow. If that doesn't grab at your heart and squeeze just hard enough to cause pain, but not enough to stop it, then your heart's not working hard enough, my friends. Look, this aria, this serenade, this love song changes everything. Its sheer radiant beauty and passion change our perception of the prince, change our perception of the story. My goodness, this love song even offers redemption, the one thing we think is beyond her, to the princess herself. Now, here's the big question. Does this sense of redemption, this sense of sheer radiant beauty and joy, this story-changing aria, does this come from the words or does it come from the music? As the Italians would say, la parole o la musica, from the words or the music, or from some combination of both, the whole greater than the parts. This forces us now, finally, to define and speak in generalizations about opera and its nature. Please, opera defined for starters. An opera is a drama which combines soliloquy, dialogue, scenery, and action, and continuous or nearly continuous music. The whole always greater than the parts. This is going to be my mantra. I'm going to chant it constantly. The whole always greater than the parts. We can talk about all the silly aspects of opera, and we will. Oh, indeed, we will. But we always must look holistically. What are we aiming for dramatically? An opera is a drama which combines soliloquy, dialogue, scenery, action, and continuous or nearly continuous music. The whole always greater than the parts. Now, literally, opera means simply musical work or musical composition. This huge repertorial world we call opera is an incredibly diverse and varied theatrical musical tradition. Look, this thing we call opera is at least as varied as this thing we call food. There's good and bad, light and heavy. Some of it is well cooked, properly prepared, and imaginatively presented, while some is served, if you'll excuse me, pretty raw. Some meals are short and to the point, and others can go on all evening. Like food, some opera is good for us, and some, frankly, is not, although the opera that's not good for us doesn't mean it's not fun. I mean, nachos aren't good for us either, but there's times when we cannot resist their lure. So let's understand that whether it's good or bad for us is not a reflection on whether we have a good time while we're there. Like food, there are distinctly nationalistic schools of opera, each of which reflect the spirit of their time, their place, and their audience. In its 400-year history, opera has been an intimate aristocratic entertainment and a huge public spectacle. Operatic stories have run the gamut from great and profound drama to a level of stupidity and vacuity that would make a TV network programmer blush. At different times, opera has celebrated mythological creatures, kings and queens, the confrontation between the upper and the lower classes, common people, the supernatural and bizarre, and the everyday and commonplace. In its 400-year history, operatic singing style has changed constantly from era to era, and even, my friends, from place to place, depending upon, one, the language being sung in, two, the size of the rooms being sung in, three, the ability and taste, or lack thereof, of the singers themselves, and four, the expectations of the audience. Please, 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 we have got to remember that for most of its history, opera was the Super Bowl halftime show, the wraparound screen surround sound theater, the computer-animated virtual reality experience of its time. In a pre-electronic age, opera was the single most stimulating, extraordinary, sweep the audience off its collective derriere into another world, special effects-dominated fantasy entertainment environment known to Western humankind. Opera, as a musical genre, is also the longest continuing running show around. For perspective, I'd like us to compare some other media genres, some notable inventions, births, and events, so that we have a sense of this extraordinary time span that operatic history represents. So, indulge me. Television, as a medium, is roughly 60 years old. Commercial radio, roughly 80 years old. Motion pictures and recorded music, roughly 100 years old. Telephone service, roughly 120 years old. I would tell you that it was in 1860 that Frederick Walton created linoleum out of linseed oil. In 1838, that Daguerre method of photography was presented to the Academy of Sciences in Paris. 1828, the first commercial railroad was built in the United States. 1824, our friend Ludwig van Beethoven completed his Ninth Symphony. In 1770, Beethoven was born. In 1756, Wolfgang Mozart was born. The genres of symphony and string quartet came into being around the year 1750. In 1732, Franz Joseph Haydn was born. In 1719, Leopold Mozart, Wolfgang's father, was born, and Daniel Defoe wrote Robinson Crusoe. In 1709, the piano, this marvelous amalgam of wood and felt and steel, was invented. In 1689, Peter the Great became the Tsar of Russia. In 1685, and this was a very good year for composers, Johann Sebastian Bach, George Frederick Handel, and Domenico Scarlatti were all born. That's 1685. Mark that one in your calendars, please. In 1667, Jonathan Swift was born. In 1666, Antonio Stradivari labeled his first violin. In 1664, British renamed New Amsterdam New York. In 1648, the Peace of Westphalia concluded the horrific 30 Years' War. 1640, the first European cafe opens in Venice. And I can assure you it was not a Starbucks. In 1633, Galileo recants. In 1626, the Dutch colony of New Amsterdam is founded on the Hudson River. 1619, the first slaves are brought to North America, arriving in Virginia. In 1613, fire destroys the Globe Theater in London. In 1612, Shakespeare completes The Tempest. 1607, the Jamestown, Virginia colony, the first English settlement on the American mainland, is founded. Also 1607, Monteverdi's Orfeo becomes the first operatic masterwork. It is composed and premiered in 1607. 1603, Queen Elizabeth I dies at 70, ostensibly still a virgin. Sir Walter Raleigh is arrested and imprisoned. 1600, Shakespeare writes Hamlet. The Dutch opticians invent the telescope. Giordano Bruno is burned as a heretic in Rome. The future King Charles I of England is born. And Jacopo Peri composes Eurydice, the earliest surviving opera. Now look, the point of this brief chronological exercise is as follows. Opera is an old musical genre. It spans a tremendous amount of recent and not so recent historical time. Much has happened in the world since the invention of opera, and the world has changed dramatically since opera was invented. Yet, opera endures. Can we say that about any other late 16th century entertainment? We cannot. So, to what do we attribute this astounding run of operatic popularity? In order to answer this question, we must get into the next body of information, a popularity, an operatic repertoire that spans 400 years of Western history. Which brings us to a presentation that I call Words and Music. So please bear with me. Ultimately, we will be listening to more operatic excerpts and talking about the essence of the words and how those words are best translated into music to heighten and intensify those words. But first, we must go back to the question asked moments ago. To what do we attribute the astounding run of operatic popularity? Indeed, let's start by quickly destroying that most typical operatic stereotype, that opera is essentially very large people be horned, and be breastplated, singing, nay, screaming nose to nose at a volume that would peel the chrome off your Chevy truck. Thank you very much. Yeah. No, that's not a good stereotype. It's just the Wagnerian one, and we will deal with that when we get to Richard Wagner. Please, opera, like any other vocal music, is posited on a simple idea, that music has the power to distill, to crystallize, and intensify the meaning of words. I'm going to say that again because this is so important. Opera, like any other vocal music, is posited on a single idea, a simple idea, that music has the power to distill, crystallize, and intensify the meaning of words. And this is, of course, what the essence of song is. We have a tendency, and it's an ugly tendency sometimes, not we, but some of the unwashed out there who don't know better, to call any piece of music a song, whether it's a symphony by Beethoven, an opera by Verdi, or indeed a pop song. A song is generally thought of as something with a simple lyric, that is a straightforward storyline set to a fairly simple accompaniment. Obviously, opera is neither simple nor simple. The words tend to be complicated, and the music even more so. Yet, at its very essence, opera is song. At its very essence, opera is words intensified by music. Now, look, many people say to me, opera is the most unnatural possible thing, these big people yelling and screaming and singing all these silly things. And on the surface, the operatic experience might seem to be unnatural. But please, what I always tell these people and would say now is observe children at play. Who's more natural than a child? They haven't learned to be embarrassed by anything yet. They haven't learned to feel foolish yet. Well, when children are at play, as often as not, they sing-song their words to each other, to their toys, to themselves. They know that they can heighten their experience and intensify the emotional content of what they're doing if they sing it rather than just speak it. You see, kids are natural-born opera composers. We just kind of lose that as we get older and we learn shame and embarrassment. What a terrible thing. Look, my friends, this is what opera is. It is the intensification of words with music. It is the institutionalization of the power of song. Now, back to that stereotypical image of opera as looking and seeming funny, because sometimes opera does look and seem funny. W. H. Auden wrote this: "No good opera plot can be sensible, for people do not sing when they are feeling sensible." And he's got a point. I'm sure we've all gone to musicals, for example, where someone starts singing and we say, "This looks really stupid. You shouldn't sing at a moment like this." We have to suspend our disbelief long enough to accept the singing as an intrinsic expression at that moment. But we must add the following to Mr. Auden's idea. People often do sing when they are feeling something powerful. Reason number one, then, for the lasting popularity of opera: the expressive power of the musical experience. Again, I quote another writer, this one T.S. Eliot, from his essay, Poetry and Drama. Please, and I quote, "It is a function of all art to give us some perception of an order in life by imposing order upon it. The painter works in selection, combination, and emphasis among the elements of the visible world, the composer in the world of sound. Now, it seems to me that beyond the nameable, classifiable emotions and motives of our conscious life, when directed towards action, the parts of life which prose drama can adequately express, there's a fringe of indefinite extent, a feeling which we can only detect out of the corner of the eye and which we can never completely focus on, a feeling of which we are only aware in a kind of temporary detachment from action." Just to cut in on Mr. Eliot for a moment, what he's talking about then is there's certain feelings we have when we just pause in repose and reflect. Not when we're actually active, but feelings we have when we pull back from action and reflect. This peculiar range of feeling can be expressed by dramatic poetry at its moments of greatest intensity. At such moments, we touch the border of those feelings which only music can truly express. So what T.S. Eliot is saying, and I find this very brave, frankly, that a poet is admitting the weakness of his art and handing over to the composer the ultimate ability to transmit those feelings that words can't, those sublime, ineffable, unknowable, yet definite feelings we all get. Now, look, we all know this is true about music. We all know music can create a sensibility that nothing else can. How many times, for example, have we heard, let's say, a song, something that we associate with our past, and for a moment in time, for a brief moment in time, we are thrust backwards. We smell the smells, we see the sights, we feel the feelings of that moment in our past that that particular piece of music, usually a song from our youth, represents to us. Now, these are extraordinary and sometimes even bittersweet moments, reminding us often of lost youth, friends, and innocence. Now, the next time this should happen to you, pull yourself back and ask yourself, you know, what if I just heard those words? Would I still be feeling these feelings and sensing these sensibilities if I'd heard the words? Or was it the music that brought back these memories and these feelings? Well, the answer is, of course, that it's the music. It was, it is, it's always the music that, to paraphrase Eliot, that evokes the fringe of indefinite feeling which we can only detect out of the corner of the eye. Oh, another quote, because I can't resist. This is from E.T.A. Hoffman, composer, philosopher, novelist, librettist, gadfly. And Hoffman wrote this about music, oh, about the year 1830. Check it out. Music is the most romantic of all the arts, as its subject is only the infinite, the secret Sanskrit of nature expressed in tones which fill the human heart with endless longing. And only in music does one understand the songs of trees, of animals, stones, and floods. Well, yeah, what he's saying is that music can evoke stuff that words can't. We'll feel feelings and experience things through pure music that words don't allow us to. This is exactly what we're talking about, and this is precisely what Hoffman is onto. Music, divorced from words, has the power to evoke feeling and experience beyond that of any other art, beyond that even of spoken language. Now, since opera combines words and music, it is the job of the music to heighten the meaning and emotional impact of the words to a level past, and I mean way past, that which the words themselves are capable. This brings us to an incredibly important concept, and I'm glad we're getting to it right here, two-thirds of the way through our first lecture, and that concept is the composer as dramatist. The composer as dramatist. In opera, my friends, it is the composer who is the dramatist, much more so than the writer of the play or libretto. Here, I've been using that term promiscuously and I haven't defined it yet. Let me do so. Libretto means little book, and a libretto is simply the play that is set to music. And writing a libretto is a specialized art, just like writing a screenplay might be. One has to be very brief and succinct and allow the composer to fill in all the gaps, just as if one is writing a screenplay, one must be constantly aware of all of the visual and other information that will add to the words that you're actually writing. So libretto writing is not just a matter of writing a play or writing a story and then handing it to a composer. It is a very advanced art on its own. And so when we talk about a librettist, we're talking about the writer of an operatic play. And when I say libretti, I'm simply sticking to the Italian and using the Italian plural rather than saying librettos, which sounds vaguely like potatoes to me. So libretti would mean many, libretto. In any case, what I'm saying is the composer is the dramatist, much more than the person who wrote the libretto or the play. Case in point, and this will illustrate it better than anything I could say. We're going to listen to the climactic aria from Mozart's opera Idomeneo. Idomeneo. This opera dates from 1780. This is Elektra's bone-chilling exit aria of Orestes and Ajax. And an exit aria is just what it sounds like. It's when a major character
has one last shot to make their point before they walk off the stage. And if they don't bring down the house with their exit aria, then the house is not going to come down for them. And so the composer has to be darn sure that he or she has supplied this featured character with music that's going to garner the maximum number of bravos and bravas, lest the singer be unhappy. And my friends, aside from feral dogs, there's nothing quite worse than an unhappy singer. All right, background. Electra is a princess in the family of Atreus, who rule in Mycenae over the kingdom of Argos. Again, Electra is a princess in the family of Atreus, who rule in Mycenae, in Greece, over the kingdom of Argos. Now, the House of Atreus is your quintessential dysfunctional Greek royal family. The father is Agamemnon, the king of Argos. Mom is the unstable Clytemnestra. The brother is Orestes, and Electra has two sisters, Iphigenia and Chrysothemis. All right, the background to our story. Before leading his invasion force to Troy, Agamemnon went hunting and killed a stag sacred to the goddess Artemis. He went hunting. He couldn't play poker. He couldn't go bowling. He couldn't do those chores around the house that he's not going to have a chance to do for the next decade or so. No, he's got to go out and kill a deer, and that's what he does. Artemis retaliates by becoming the sea beneath Agamemnon's fleet until he, Agamemnon, sacrifices his daughter Iphigenia to the goddess. Now, this does not go over big at all with Clytemnestra, who is furious and, of course, cannot forgive her husband. We must also keep in mind that Agamemnon was the same person who killed Clytemnestra's first husband and child in order to marry her in the first place. So, while Agamemnon is at war with the boys, Clytemnestra takes as her lover Aegisthius. Together, she and Aegisthius kill Agamemnon after his return. Yeah, they bop him over the head with a double-headed axe while he's taking a bath. All right. Orestes, of course, is besides himself, and he avenges his father's death by murdering Clytemnestra and Aegisthius, after which the Furies hound him into madness for his matricide. It's just one of these basic days in Greece, right? All right. Now, in one of the versions of this story, Electra, already nearly insane herself, dies from joy at the news of her mother's murder. In another version of the story, Electra leaves Argos and wanders all around the Mediterranean, crazed with rage and grief. Which brings us, at last, to Mozart's version of this story, the opera Idomeneo, Re de Creta, Idomeneo, King of Crete, 1780. Mozart wrote the music. Gian Battista Varesco wrote the libretto. Now, the action takes place, as you would guess, on Crete, following the conclusion of the Trojan War. Electra is there, in Crete, mourning her father's death and her brother's madness. She is unbalanced, but not at least yet, off her rocker. All right, Electra has fallen in love with the heir to the Cretan throne, Prince Idamante. Electra's rival for Idamante is the kind and sweet and beautiful Elia. Don't you just hate her already? She's the kind of person that makes everybody crazy. She's a Trojan princess who's been brought to Crete initially as a prisoner, but now that the war is over, she is free. Well, needless to say, Electra loses out in this particular triangle, and near the very end of the opera, the announcement of Elia and Idamante's betrothal is made. And I would tell you that the already bitchy, vindictive, and unstable Electra absolutely loses it. She goes bonkers, nuts, ballistic. This is the moment that we join the opera. And these are the words Mozart's librettist, Gian Battista Varesco, supplies for this key dramatic moment. Electra. I feel the torments of Orestes and Ajax in my breast. The image of Alecto was one of the Furies, frightens me to death. Tear my heart, you horned serpents, or I shall end my pain with a sword. Period. Fini. Now, if I'm Mozart and I say, this is the moment. This is the moment that Elektra has the stage and owns the audience. And I'm handed these words. I utter that one word most necessary to the composer. Rewrite! But there is no rewrite, because Mozart's a stud. Mozart says, look, she has much to feel, and I've got to give her time to feel it. So let's read these words again, and then let's listen to what Mozart does with these useless, flat, unimaginative words in giving Elektra one of the most galvanizing moments in the whole history of opera. Again, I feel the torments of Orestes and Ajax in my breast. The image of Elektra frightens me to death. Frightens. What are the cues that Mozart's going to run with? He's going to run with fear and terror. Second verse. Tear my heart, you horned serpents, or I shall end my pain with a sword. All right. First she says, tear my heart, you know, mutilate me, hurt me, make me suffer, make me feel pain. I mean, there's some real masochism here. And if you don't, I will end my pain with a sword. So if you don't hurt me, I'll kill myself. You know, the more we think about these words, the more we can see there's a great potential for hysterics here, and that's what Mozart gives us. Now, I'm going to point out a couple of things. We will listen, and then I'll point out these elements again, because I want us to hear what he does with these words. We're going to hear in the accompaniment, blum-blump, 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 these whipping, flagellating musical ideas, and she's virtually whipping herself, flaying her own flesh. This music fluctuates between violent self-abuse and deep pain. Now, if you had to write an aria like that, where would you put these words in the soprano's tessitura or her range? And there's a very useful word to use, my friends, if nothing else, for crossword puzzles. Tessitura refers to the height of a singer's range. Well, where in the singer's tessitura will we put this? As high as possible. She has to screech. She has to scream. She cannot sound attractive and controlled. She has to sound out of control. So Mozart will not only stick her high up, but she's going to be jumping all over the place. Anything to sound out of control. We're going to have all kinds of obsessive repetitions. She's not just going to say, tear my heart, you horned serpents, you horned serpents, you horned serpents. She's going to say, tear my heart, tear, 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 my heart, my heart, my heart, my heart. Yes, she is going to get obsessive, and that sense of obsession will be translated into her madness. Please, at the very end, Mozart has a wonderful moment where we hear this absolutely mad laughter. I mean, it sounds like something out of a bad horror movie, but of course, since horror movies are still, oh, a good 170 years away at the time Mozart writes this, we have to realize that Mozart's coming up with this idea himself. This hysterical, strange, and blood-curdling laughter we hear at the end, let's just be really aware of it when it happens. So, let's jump in, let's listen to this aria, and let's ask ourselves, who's the dramatist? Varesco or Mozart? Thank you. I can assure you, when you see Idomeneo and Electra sings this aria and she runs off the stage completely crazed at the end, everyone goes ape. It tells us two things. First of all, it tells us that the bad guys are always more interesting than the good guys. They're much more complex and they're frankly more fun. We don't necessarily want to date them, but we certainly want to watch their actions. And second of all, it tells us that Mozart's a magician. We knew that, but this reinforces what we know, that these words by themselves are flat, but with the application of music, a whole three-dimensional person and character becomes visible. Now, we've been talking, and we will continue to talk as we move into the second lecture, about why opera has endured for 400 years. And the first reason was the power of music to transmit information words cannot. It is the music that makes her insane. It's those crazy leaps from low to high. It's the emphasis on her high vocal range. It's the obsessive repetition of words, that hysterical laughter at the end. It is the music that creates the character, and this is the first reason for the enduring popularity of opera. I asked before, who is the dramatist here? Who creates this character? Now, my friends, in a stage play, it is indeed the actors that interpret the words, but in an opera, the composer has already interpreted the words by setting them to music in a specific way. It's up to the singer now to realize what the composer has created. Now, yes, indeed, we could say that the singer is interpreting the composer, but not really. The singer should just be singing what's on the page and doing it as well they could. The words have already been interpreted. They've been interpreted by the composer. It is the composer who is the dramatist. When we return for our second lecture, we will voyage into the second reason behind the enduring popularity of opera, and that has to do with the lasting dramatic effectiveness of the complementary nature of words and music. So, until then, I thank you. Welcome back to How to Listen to and Understand Opera. This is Lecture 2, and we are working our way through this introductory set of lectures. Right now, we're talking about the reasons behind the lasting expressive power and popularity of opera itself. And the first reason, what we talked about back in Lecture 1, had to do with the expressive power of the purely musical experience. That is, those things that music can tell us that words cannot. We proceed. Reason number two for the lasting dramatic effectiveness and popularity of opera has to do with the complementary nature of words and music, the self-reflective nature of words, and the emotionally reflective nature of music. Please, I quote from Eric Plaut's marvelous book, Grand Opera. Quote, words and music are our two most powerful languages for emotional communication. Speech expresses a form of symbolic thinking, and speech is unique in that it alone allows self-reflective thinking. Only through speech do we become able to think about thinking. The capacity for self-reflecting thinking comes, like most things in life, at some cost. Although it makes thought more precise and capable of generalizations and abstraction, its development results in the loss of potential for other capacities. Lost with the development of speech is some of the all-embracing quality of emotional response. The infant does not separate emotion from perception or sensation. The infant reacts in a total way. Indeed, those of us who have had or have infants know that to be true. With self-reflective speech, some of that quality of immediacy is lost. Music speaks to us in a language that is not self-reflective. Music retains more of the capacity for immediate, total emotional response that we lose with speech. Music does not have the capacity for logical reasoning and problem solving of self-reflecting speech. And neither, if I might add gratuitously, do musicians generally, if you'll excuse me. Rather, music can describe aspects of life and feeling that speech cannot. For example, we're going to listen to and talk about a song. This is not from an opera. It's a song by Gustav Mahler, the marvelous Bohemian-born and Austrian and New York-careered composer and conductor. I would tell you a little bit about Mahler. I had to sneak him in somehow. This is a kind of surreptitious way to do it. He's one of my favorite composers. And he was simply the most famous opera conductor in his time. At the turn of the century, Mahler was the great conductor of operas and was considered an okay composer, but his great fame and fortune were made as a conductor. The great question everyone asked was, well, if he's such a great opera conductor, which he was, why doesn't he write operas? And indeed, Mahler wrote symphonies. Early in his life, he wrote many songs, first for piano and voice, and then for orchestra and voice. And later in life, he wrote some more orchestral songs, capped by the marvelous Das Lied von der Erde. But essentially, he was a composer of instrumental symphonies. So Mahler didn't write the opera he might have written for reasons we can't get into now. This is not a Mahler course. Suffice to say for now, he's a brilliant conductor of operas, a brilliant interpreter of vocal music, a brilliant writer of vocal music, and that's why I'm using him now, because we've got to understand the complementary power of words and music, and Mahler's as good a vehicle as any. This is a song from a group of songs called The Songs of a Wayfarer, and it's a piece that dates from 1884, and the orchestral version that we will hear from 1896. Mahler himself wrote the poems. He fancied himself, as all adolescents do, a very oversensitive person, capable of brilliant poetry. He learned later in life to stop setting his own poems, but nevertheless, early in life, he did set them, and this poem has a certain rustic charm to it. Let me read it to you, and then let's talk about the emotional and expressive content of the poem. And then, of course, we'll talk about Mahler's options. How will he set this to music? What will be the cues in the poem that will allow him to get an optimum musical setting that will intensify, distill, and crystallize the meaning of the words? The name of the poem is Ging heut morgen übers Feld, As I Walked Through the Field This Morning. As I walked through the field this morning, the dew still hung upon the grass. The merry finch called out to me, Hey, hey you there, good day to you. Isn't this a splendid world? Splendid world, tweet, tweet, fine and bright. Oh, how I love the world. And the bluebell in the field told of good cheer with its bell ting-a-ling as it rang its morning greeting. Isn't this a splendid world, ding-ding, beautiful thing. Oh, how I love the world. Hoorah! And all the world began to glow in the sunshine. In the sunshine, all things took on color and sound, flower and bird, things great and small. Good day, good day. Isn't this a splendid world? Hey, you there, lovely world. Will my happiness now flower too? No, no. I know that it can never bloom for me. Now, the first three stanzas of this poem are completely happy and quite descriptive. Only the fourth stanza is self-reflective, and it's, of course, reflective of loneliness and unhappiness. As poetry, we only realize in the fourth stanza that the first three stanzas are an example of forced cheerfulness. You know, our disappointed young lover is wandering through nature and trying to feel good about himself and about the world, or I suppose this could be a young lady, although it was written for a male voice, trying to hide behind the beauties of nature, trying to hide from a broken heart. We might say that this gentleman is taking a trip in Egypt. He's in denial. Anyway, look, we must ask ourselves two questions. What will Mahler's music tell us that the words do not and cannot? And secondly, how will Mahler's setting support the self-reflection of that final stanza, of the fourth stanza? Will Mahler get real dramatic? Will there be agonized music used to illustrate the terrible realization that, quote, love will never bloom for me, unquote? All right, here's what Mahler does. First of all, this music is rustic and engaging, and it reflects a happy out-of-doors nature that is described well in the first three stanzas of the poem. So we should expect for this rustic, almost folk-like poetry, a rustic and very sophisticated, if folk-like, melodic material to accompany it. By stanza three, the music is going to begin to slow down, and Mahler tells us to start slowing down. Indeed, we will slow down noticeably. Isn't this a splendid world becomes, isn't this a splendid world? Question mark, more than exclamation mark. Indeed, the emotional clock runs down over the entire course of this wonderful song. Stanza four slows the beautiful and rustic melody to a crawl. And I would tell you that the sweetness of the music gives this stanza a bittersweet heartbreak. I mean, a real sense of agony that histrionics and screaming never could. You know, it's true, and we all know this is true. Sometimes it's better to make our point quietly and elegantly than with lots of screaming and howling. Now, Elektra needs to scream and howl. It is her nature as a member of the House of Atreus. But not for Mahler. Our gentleman simply winds down, and I would tell you that the poem, the song, reaches its climax. We have a complete emotional breakdown on the words, nimmer, nimmer, never, never will love bloom for me. The song ends with a sustained instrumental sigh in the orchestra. This is a brilliant, deeply moving setting of these words. Please, let's listen. Gustav Mahler, Songs of a Wayfarer, Number 2, 1884, orchestrated in 1896.
Ging heut Morgen übers Feld, taube auf den Gräsern hin, sprach zu mir der Lustgefühl, ei du Geld. Hohe Morgen, ein Geld, wo wird's nicht eine schöne Welt, schöne Welt? Zwingt, zwingt, doch blinkt, wie mir doch die Welt gefällt. Auch die Glockenblume am Feld hat mir lustig guter Ding, mit den Glöckchen klinge, 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 kling. Jeden Morgen muss geschehen, wird's nicht eine schöne Welt, schöne Welt. Ich lieb, schönes Ding, wie mir doch die Welt gefällt. Heia! fängt auch mein Glück an.
Now, isn't that something? Very effective, very brilliant, very simple, very direct. Best solutions are usually the obvious ones. And he takes his cue from this fourth verse, the self-reflective verse. But everything in the song leads to that moment. It is a beautiful example of the self-reflective nature of words complemented by the emotionally reflective nature of music. Okay. Reason number three for the lasting dramatic effectiveness and popularity of opera.